Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to HJT Design Radio Straight Talk, a show dedicated to exploring all aspects of creating a great dental office, where the only dumb question is the question that's not asked. Here's Jim and Han.
Good evening. Jim Jarvis here, along with my co-host, Han Tran. Han, how are you?
I am doing fantastic, Jim. Just simply fantastic. How about you?
Absolutely okay. We're actually real thankful because literally 2 minutes ago, Han and I were not connected with each other. And so talk about being right down to the wire, but electronics, don't we? We love computers when we love them, and we hate them when we hate them, don't we?
Yes, we do. You know, you have to look at no matter what the challenges that you have, there's always a worse challenge to that other people is going through. This morning I look at the weather. I wasn't aware because I normally don't tune into the news. And I was, my wife brought to my attention that there was a tornado that went through Alabama. And I go, wow, what a swatch of destruction. And I just, any challenge that we have, you look at it and say, thank God that's all we're not experiencing. So, technology is minor stuff, right?
Yeah, it is. Well, obviously, welcome to Straight Talk. We're at episode number 98, and tonight's topic is going to be, now what do I do? I was like, wow, that's an open-ended title. Well, in reality, it kind of is. We've got right now so much new stuff that's happening. We've got a new president, vice president. We've got new members in both, the House and Senate. We've got new challenges. We've got new advantages. We've got lots of other uncertainties. It's just so many things that are out there. And, to top it all off, as businessmen and women, you're trying to figure out what to do. And what's the best direction or what's the best decision? And so, Han and I have been over the years and years and years, we hear so much of this. I want to call it common misleading advice. Han, am I being politically correct or am I being too nice? I don't know. But, it's just stuff that's thrown out on the internet or other places, that's really nothing more than somebody's wild idea or an opinion that's, lack of a better term, kind of garbage. And so really you got to get down to the facts. What are the facts? What's the art to getting to the point where you can actually determine what the facts are or aren't? You're bombarded. We're bombarded. We see it. We're bombarded by all of these opinions that are portrayed as facts, and we're here to help you get through those. Now, you might say, well, you guys are just no different than anybody else. You're just going to have your own opinion. You're going to have your own thought. Well, yes, Han and I are, we'll say it, we're very opinionated. Aren't we, Han?
Yes, we're very opinionated. Because we're entitled to. The main thing that we often say is we give you our input, our thought, and then we encourage you to confirm it, do your own research, and that way you know whether what we share with you is useful hot air or useful materials. So,
right.
Yeah.
And the big thing is it's backed up by facts. And we'll present those facts. That's really what makes us different. And we take pride in that. We feel that it's important to give you the information. Like we've always said, we're never going to tell you what you should do. We're going to give you all of the facts. We're going to give you the possibilities. We're going to give you the options. And we're going to say, here's the pros and the cons of each. You choose, because it's your decision. It's your practice. It's your whatever you're going to be trying to accomplish. So, you know, we're not going to sit there and say, you got to do this and you got to do that. You got to do this. Now, if you ask our opinion on what we would do in your particular situation, we'll give it to you. And we'll also say, these are the reasons why. So, you know, that's a big difference between that and somebody saying, well, just, you know, you need to do this or you need to do that. So it's kind of important to us to kind of debunk some of the things that are out there, because like I was saying before, we see it over the years. We've seen it for years about this is the latest thing, or this is the thing that you should do, or this is the direction you should go, or this is how you should, you know, today's issue, of course, is dealing with infection control and COVID and keeping your doors open and keeping yourself and your staff and your patients safe. Well, you know, Han and I have done a ton of research, and we're still researching on looking at the newest and greatest and the most practical solutions to those problems. So let's kind of jump into some of these things, and we're just going to start tonight's discussion. And don't get us wrong, we're not trying to bang on anybody, any particular person or group or entity, but we strongly feel it's very important that you hear the facts. Here's one that just kind of gets to me. Older practices will lose patients to new startups because of infection control. Well, that whole thought, that whole comment is, I think, very misleading at the least, and totally false in reality. What do you think about older practices? Well, let's start with the solution. A new practice, that's supposed to be a new building. It's supposed to be clean and sterile, right?
Yeah, perception-wise, it's new, because new is better than old. I mean, that's just the way we look at the whole world. You know, a new car is more appealing than an old car. Same thing for house, you know, clothing and whatever. In perception, yes, we believe that because it's new, it got to be better, more sterile, and what have you. However, that is a very subjective, very up for great debate. It's perception.
And really, it's not reality, because the minute you open your doors and let one individual into your practice that may be infectious, your whole facility is no longer sterile. It doesn't matter how clean the walls are, how pretty the new paint looks, how unused the particular area is, because the facts are, as my sister, who's basically in charge of the whole issue of infection control and all that microbiology stuff in her company that she works for, has brought out, the scientific facts are saying that the majority of this virus is transmitted through airborne particles, and that the pathogen then lights onto surfaces, and obviously you either inhale it or ingest or get it into your system. And that's how the majority of the time that you're infected. And you may say, guys, why are you still talking about infection? Well, because it's still here. Yeah, I know vaccines have been started to be put out, but thousands and thousands and thousands of people are still getting this virus. And you know the scariest thing I heard today, Han? It was in a commentators dealing with issues with China. And the thought that was brought out was that something had to happen, because, sure, you know, maybe we're getting a little bit of a handle on COVID, but what happens when the next virus is released? Wow. You know, that kind of hit me in the sense that, and we've talked about it, but it hit me. Right. We're not, this isn't like a one-time thing. We can't say, okay, once we get done with COVID, then we're going to say, all right, everything's hunky-dory. We're going to go back to the way we used to do stuff. I don't think so.
No, I think our world had been on a constant race to, you know, to the next cure against the next pathogens. And so it's a, you know, you're trying to stay ahead of what's the next onslaught of disease and problems. So, you're right. We're not, this is, there's not a cure, but there is a, a situation of trying to contain it or reduce it, minimize its effect on the population. And then you try to gear yourself up for the next one to come. So it's an endless battle.
And I think we've proven in all of our, go back to our listen to our podcast and the discussions that we've talked about, that you can make any existing facility a very clean environment where you minimize the potential of the pathogen and you getting infected and your staff and your patients. Now, nobody can guarantee that you're going to be 100% sterile. There's not a facility around that can guarantee that, at least not one that's a public facility. Sure, you might have some of these laboratories and that kind of stuff where, you know, they're hermetically sealed, but that's not practical for a practical practice like yours where you have multiple people coming in and out and that kind of stuff. So obviously it's a numbers game. We want to minimize the potential of being infected and keep that to a bare minimum. But the fallacy that old versus new, well, new was always better and clean. That's not the case. There are systems, there's methodology, there are things that you can do to your existing facility, and we've gone over all those, to be able to keep that facility clean. And actually, if you did those, you're going to be in a better position than you would than a new startup who just opened their doors and did none of the proper system protections that have been laid out. Because the minute they open their doors and someone walks in that's infectious, the whole building's infected and it's spreading the pathogen throughout the building to everybody else, and there's no level of protection in there. Yeah, it's clean. Well, it was. It's new, but it doesn't mean it's clean. And so, that's just a big misconception that I think we just need to address, that just because you put a new coat of paint on the walls or if you have a brand new facility, that you're going to automatically get patients from the other existing places that people are scared to go to. Now, will your existing patients be looking to leave your practice because you're old and somebody up down the road is got a new startup? They might, if you don't do anything. Because, Han, I think you touched on it, perception. A lot of times, perception, people make decisions based upon feelings. Usually they don't make decisions based on facts. It's how do they feel? Well, the perception is, perception is new is clean, and so I'm going to go to the new place because it's going to be less chance of me getting COVID there than I get if I continue to go to the dentist that I have been going to for the last 15 years because he hasn't done anything or she hasn't.
Yeah, let me add a little bit to that too, Jim. If the claim is that you have a new office that people will drive to it because it's new and it's clean. But would that also be true that 6 months down the road, a couple of miles away, is a brand new office that just opened, that those same patients will be running to that new place because it's newer and supposed to be cleaner? So that way of thinking is, yes, I think it's disingenuous. Because you can do, for instance, if we look at a new facility, for instance, there is, you have to compare apple to apple to actually even ascertain what is, you know, which one would be better. You know, facility A, who may be 20 years old, and facility B, who, you know, that is only a couple months old. But the material, the system, the overall, you know, buildings and mechanical system, the infrastructure, if it's inferior, being new, but it's inferior in its design and in its technology compared to the older one, you know, the older office where you have a long, you know, history of treatment, of, you know, interactions and trust and all that stuff. You wouldn't just simply say, I'm, you know, there's a new shinier object down the road. I'm going to ditch this one. I'm going to run down there to see what it is. And if the, you know, if the service at the new place isn't up to par, the facility may be new and shiny, but is that better value? Is that better service? So, yeah, I think Jim and I are in agreement that it's being new and being shiny doesn't always mean better. Jim?
Or clean or sterile, yes.
Right.
Now, you know, there's always the thinking that, hey, with the new dental startup, you can get out there and, you know, get a whole lot of great media coverage. You can get, you know, coverage on the front page of the local newspaper. You can maybe get a spot on the evening news, maybe even get some local business leaders posting on social media and create this synergy of marketing that, hey, there's this new place down the road. But it's that same thinking that you just talked about, Han. In reality, there is no reason why an existing established facility cannot do the exact same thing. And here's the way you spin it. And I use the word spin because I don't know of another word, but here's the way you portray it. You portray it is that, yes, we're established. But on top of that, we are now integrating all of these new technologies. Okay, the technologies, and we've listed them before, but I can go down through them. You know, obviously, UV lights in the ductwork to sterilize the air as it passes through. We're utilizing state-of-the-art aerosol removal system, maybe something in the line of what Dr. Crank had portrayed, that's at the patient to be able to minimize and reduce the aerosol or the pathogen at the patient. We're using state-of-the-art systems and cleaning technologies to be able to reduce the potential of the pathogen on surfaces. You just go down through those and do the exact same thing that a startup would do. Get yourself on the front page of the local newspaper. Get yourself a spot on the evening news, okay? And, you know, start getting this out on social media that this is what you are doing to keep your facility clean, to keep your facility safe, but mostly make it so that your patients feel extremely comfortable, because then it's a win-win, because one, they already trust you. They already trust you to keep coming back as an existing patient. So on top of that, if you prove to them, well, and I don't need to look anywhere else because you're also keeping this as a sterile environment in this new reality that we have of infection through a COVID or whatever the next virus or whatever is going to happen down the road, you're going to be much better off because you have an existing base of clients, patients that you'll be able to retain and keep. And they won't need to go look down the road and that perception that, oh, the guy down the road or the girl down the road with the new facility is clean. Won't matter. Will it, Hunt?
Yeah, and I think, you know, there is a there's guidelines that health guidelines from the CDC and the American Dental Association recommend that you have to adhere to. So all the other things that Jim was talking about is going beyond beyond the requirement. So if you invest into technologies and stuff like that that further reinforce and keep your facility more clean or more protected, brag about it, okay? But be I think just letting your patient know that you are meeting the guideline, the required guideline, and you also invest into other technologies that that further reinforce that requirement is a good thing. So brag about it, promote it, get it out there, like Jim say. And again, just because it's new does mean it comes that the facility owner of the new place actually invest in it, with the technologies. They may even have to learn what they have to do to meet the standard minimum regulatory requirement. So that's that, Jim.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and again, we don't need to or feel that it's important to beat up on any individual person or group, but it's like, think about this. Does it really make sense to just follow that advice from an individual without knowing the actual facts and the issues to be able to make an informed decision? And we think not. I think it's much better to have the facts and all the data and the information so that you can make an informed decision before you decide to do something. Now, the folks that are let's say you're an existing lease in an existing facility and your landlord won't allow you to do the things that you want to do. Now, that's a situation that for whatever reason, let's say, for example, won't let you put UV lights in the ductwork, or it's impractical to do that because of whatever system. Now, that right there, that's a bad situation, and you need to find a way to get out. Because if you want to accomplish what you want to accomplish, and you believe, like we believe, that that's a proper and prudent protection level that you want to get to, then yeah, it may mean that you have to start up a new location or go to another place or do something like that. But that's probably more rare than it is common. I mean, I can't imagine that an existing landlord is not going to let you go in and alter some of the systems like ductwork and that kind of stuff, because you're really doing them a favor. You're providing a much better facility, because we all know they own the building, they own the ductwork, they own the equipment, they own the HVAC equipment and everything, and so you're upgrading that. You'll never take it with you when you leave, although some of it you might be able to, but so it's an advantage and an asset for them. Again, I can't see how a landlord is going to say, no, you can't do that. Thoughts on that?
Yeah, I agree with you. I think it's if there's a tenant that are willing to invest into their facility and upgrade it, you know, whatever technologies, it adds value so that the next person or the next tenant would already have that in place. It makes it more valuable for the landlord. So I would be confused to, you know, to hear that the landlord say no. And unless the facility cannot physically be modified for whatever reason, that it would be weird for somebody to say no when it's a no-brainer decision.
Right, John? Right. I mean, and there are systems, there are the mechanical systems and those kind of things that will not allow you to put some of these technologies into place. We've talked about those. If you decided you wanted to go with like HEPA filtrations and that kind of stuff, you might be taxing the equipment, or the equipment may not even be designed to be able to receive those. But we have talked about solutions that could be placed in just about any scenario. So there's not a lack of information, and there's not a lack of facts that you can base that decision upon. Here's an interesting one. I wanted to kind of throw out there, and Han and I were laughing about it, but it's kind of falling in the realm of, here's the question: does your practice have a climbing wall? And when I read that, I went, really? In this day and age, in this particular environment, when one, very few patients are in your lobby in the first place. Individuals, and Han, you were describing this. This really falls into the realm of, you know, the latest and greatest, the new. Well, how'd you put it? Yeah, the new trend. Yeah, what'd you call that?
Yeah. I can't remember, but it's, you know, again, to the ages, there's gurus that sell you on, you know, on branding, for instance. You know, you've got to set yourself apart from the other guys down the road. You know, some of the things that we in the recent year that we read about and personally experienced. In the old days, it used to be, it's nice that my dentist have a coffee, you know, maybe a coffee station, so that we can have a cup of coffee while we wait. And then that kind of blossomed into, you know, a beverage counter that offer you, you know, varieties of flavors of coffees and tea and, you know, cappuccinos and what have you. And I even read one where they provide wine. Don't laugh. I read that. That was a dentist that was bragging about it. Okay. And so you look at, okay, what's the other trend that you might see? Multiple TV is still a huge trend. You know, hot towels. You have, there's at one time, it's, you can go to your dentist and get a massage while you wait. You might even get a wax job when you get your dental work done. So there's just, you know, the latest and greatest, you know, groundbreaking things that you got to have to set yourself apart. I've seen theaters. You name it, it's people are trying, but does it make sense? I guess the main thing is, does it really make sense? We design offices, and you know, and we want to believe that our client, the dentist, is going to have a really efficient, well designed, well built, high value facility for, you know, for the life of their career. And many, many times it's hard to, you know, to convince or to, you know, to advocate that our client spend a few extra dollars to do, to do a certain feature, to give them more, more usability, better function, and so on, because it required leasing a few more square feet. But at the same token, we have dealt with businesses who won't do that, but because they want to be more trendy, and they will invest $50,000, $100,000, $200,000 into a theme, okay? Like maybe Mickey Mouse or Jungle Jim or whatever it is that would they feel that their marketing guru or the branding guru say, you know, it will bring in more patients. I just relate that new thing is cool, but it's like buying a new car. It smells great. It feels great. You won't do anything in it except drive it, and you wash it every week and so on. It gets old after a few months, okay? So it becomes a poorly invested in items that don't really give you any more value except short-term gratification. So when we look at things like Jim was talking about, a climbing wall, and I've raised children, okay? We worked on a children's hospital. There's a thinking process behind designing a facility where adult use and children use. And if you are a parent, you can have a great day until your little Johnny fall and scrape their knees and screaming and all that. But it's worse if you're the business owner and you create a really nice, cool, trendy climbing wall. And little Johnny climbed on it, and he fell and he broke his arm before he's coming to see you for cleaning. It just doesn't make sense. There's better way to do things. I'm just not sure exactly what it is, but it just seems like it's just an ill advice to create something that that could potentially be that increase the risk and liability issue for your practice. Jim?
Yeah, exactly. And in context, to be fair, the context around that particular discussion was, you know, you want to create a practice that's an extension of you, and that would be something that people of like minds would be gravitating towards, and they would come to you because you have the same kind of interests. Well, that's a great marketing thought, but in reality, does it really make a lot of sense in this day and age? I mean, you're not getting the piles of people that you typically would have in the first place that are sitting in your lobby. That's been minimized because of COVID. And will probably be that way forever. We will never have the big lobbies that, you know, are full with a dozen plus people waiting to have their procedures done. Those days are long gone, and we feel that we don't ever see those back again.
I'd be surprised if we go back to that, Jim.
Oh no, I can't see it ever happening again. And so, on top of that, the whole direction and mindset of, okay, how do you make the experience of going to the dentist, coming to your facility, how do we make that pleasurable? Because that's really what it's all about, right? You want to make it comfortable. You want to make it pleasurable. You want to make the patient feel at ease, and they will want to come back. Well, yes. So how do you do that? Well, we have lots of ideas, and there's lots of ways that can be accomplished. But the biggest one is, like Han, you were talking about before the show, we deal with life,
safety, and health.
Safety and health. That's exactly right. So when that patient feels safe. That's the first criteria. It's not when they feel comfortable. It's when they feel safe. That's the big hurdle nowadays. They have to feel safe. And the facts behind that, it's not just Han's opinion or my opinion. There's facts behind that. When an individual feels safe, they'll continue to come back again. Because right now, what is everybody feeling? Unsafe. They're scared to death to go outside. They're scared to death to go to work. They're scared to death to go to the grocery store. And it's being constantly reinforced by all the limitations and the shutdowns and, you know, lack of getting this or lack of getting that or people getting sick and quarantines that are necessary and, you know, all the stuff that we're being bombarded with. So job one, if we want to take a phrase from Ford Motor Company, job one is safety. We're talking about safety when it comes to dealing with infection. Okay, that should be your number one priority, to be able to bring and draw and attract patients. To keep them, to bring them in for the brand new, is having to do with the safety. And then once you've got them and you show them that you're supplying all the necessary protocols and procedures, being able to be safe at what you're doing, they'll continue to come back, along with, if you give them excellent service, which we know you will, you'll keep your patients, so that when somebody down the road who listens to the recommendations of others and says, start up a new practice because it's shiny and clean, you'll get all the patients from everyone else around you. And that won't happen to you, because you've already shown your existing patients and your potential new patients that you have all the systems in place to be just as safe in your building and in your practice as if it was a brand new one. So I guess that's my kind of my soapbox for tonight when it comes to dealing with some of the things that are out there. Now, Han, you wanted to talk about what was that discussion with the construction costs and how we see so many things around the internet. Go ahead.
Yeah, we have covered this in some of our blogs and even some of our radio program from time to time. I see the same question by different people and same response from, you know, from the same people. And I think it's worthwhile once in a while bring it up and talk about it. The question is always, you know, when a dentist, because that's who we deal with, is entertaining the idea of building a new office, whether it's in a lease space and doing a tenant build out, or they're established and they're looking at brand, you know, building it, buying land, building a brand new building and things like that. So the latter part, they've been around a couple, you know, or sometimes, so they have some idea what they're get into. But once in a while, you got an anomaly where somebody's starting fresh out, an associate, and they jump in head first. I'm going to buy a piece of land. I'm going to build a brand new building and just tell me what it would cost, per square foot to build a brand new building. And they get sticker shock when they get things like $300 to $400 per square foot to put up a brand new building. Okay, so we can cover some of that. Another question is, I'm looking at doing a new office in an existing medical office building, and I just, you know, can anybody share with me what the average construction cost would be? Those are typically a very open-ended question because there's so many things that could play, with the final cost. Jim, on the average construction cost, could you share with our listener of the items certainly we can't cover everything, but you know, some of the major items that could drive the cost of the project up, or the number, ultimately the number up.
No, well, actually, you're hitting on probably the most important aspect of this whole discussion or question, and it has to do with the volatility of construction costs. Now, construction costs are broken into two parts. You have labor and you have materials. That's it. There's just two pieces, labor and materials, both of which are volatile. Material. Let's talk about that one first. Have you gone out and bought a 2x4 lately? Well,
that's pretty.
Yeah, 2x4s have quadrupled in cost in just the last 6 months. And they could be going up even more. They're very volatile. Construction material, wood, other materials that are used to put together your building, even to build just walls within your existing building. It changes, and it changes sometimes on a daily basis. Now, in some regions, a certain type of material might be cheaper than another type of material. For example, a wood stud might be cheaper in one locale versus a steel stud in another locale within the country. So there's that differentiation between costs. Now, so, you know, here in Ohio, a 2x4 wall costs a certain amount today. Tomorrow might be something else. But compare that to, for example, California. That same wall is going to be substantially higher. Now, why is that? Is it because it takes so much longer to get a 2x4 to Ohio or a 2x4 to California? Actually, California is a lot closer than Ohio is to where the major lumber yards are, because they're typically located in the Northwest. A lot of our lumber comes from Canada, and the Northwest region of the country, both the U.S. and Canada, is probably the 75 to 80% of the lumber comes there, from there. So you would think, it would be cheaper to get a 2x4 to Los Angeles than it would be to Ohio just because of the distance. Well, you're probably right, it is. But what's the other reason? The other reason is the thing we haven't talked about, and it has to do with labor. Labor costs are very volatile, and that really is a factor of just one, how busy people are, how busy are the contractors, how busy are the trades contractors and the subcontractors and the people that put together those 2x4s to turn them into things like walls and buildings. And if they're busy and see that they're going to be even more busy, then the costs go up. Or if there's a cost that they have to incur to be able to do business within the region, the costs are going to be higher. That's why it costs more money to build per square footage in California than it does in, you know, Ohio or Indiana. And it has to do with the labor costs and the associated costs around having laborers that live in that region and work in that region. So costs are so volatile and so different between even regions, sometimes even between cities and regions within the same state, that here's a prime example. Downtown Chicago. Your costs in downtown Chicago are going to be substantially higher than costs that are in, for example, North Aurora, which is, you know, an hour or so outside of downtown. It's just the way it is. You're still in, you know, the same state, but it has to do with the one, availability of labor, the associated cost with that labor, and what you have to pay to be able to get that laborer to do the work that needs to be done. So really, it's impossible to know to answer that question that you just posed, what's the average construction cost of a practice or a building? It's impossible to put a number to it. And I like to call it a wild ass guess. And it's not even an educated wild ass guess, because on a period it might be that, but a month from now, if something were to happen that drives up a particular thing, then all of a sudden that number's different. Look at last month. What was the situation with, we've got production on the XL pipeline going, right? Now, all of a sudden, it got shut down today. A whole bunch of people got laid off. What's going to happen to oil costs? You know what's going to happen to oil costs. They're going to go up.
Yeah.
Because
it's already going up.
Yeah, the perceived potential of what that was going to do in the way of getting available oil to us here in the U.S. is gone. And so now it's going to have to come some other way, and that other way is going to cost more money. So the same kind of thing could happen. And then you have just a multitude of volatile kind of things that will drastically affect your construction cost. So,
there's a couple of things that you have.
Yeah.
Jim, there's a couple of things that you haven't, discussed or talked about, the potential items that could, cause the number to go higher. Is that if you build seasonal construction time frame, does add cost to the project?
Absolutely.
Okay, and another item that we have all gone through for the last year, that stinking thing called COVID, it add more cost to the project too. So there are just so many things that could happen, as part of your project that drive the cost up. Rarely that we ever see the cost of the project decreases. But there's always something that can be add on to make the price higher.
Right.
Okay, so it's
now,
very
the ahead, very John. Best person, the very best entity to ask the question of what something's going to cost when it comes to construction is a contractor. Okay, a person who deals with it on a day-to-day basis, builds things on a day-to-day basis, puts up walls on a day-to-day basis. So they are a great resource. So I would say have your architect or your designer have a discussion with some of their contacts and get an idea of what the costs are in your region, in that particular area. That's probably the best advice on how to get a handle on what the costs are. Going online and asking the question to whomever, what the average cost is.
You get it. It's all over the place.
Useless information. I wouldn't hold anything on that.
Let me add a couple of cents to your thing, Jim. Jim and I both agree on that point, is that the ideal candidate give you what the cost of the project may be. Is the contractor, because they live in that. They do estimate on their project and stuff. The added value to that is they have to have something to work with, okay? Simply say, hey, I'm looking at...
Very good point, yes.
Yeah, so to simply say that I'm going to build a 5,000 square foot office, what would it cost me? That is an open-ended, a question. But if you say, I'm building a 5,000 square foot office, this is what my designer or architect had laid out, for that 5,000 square foot office, then it give them something to look at, something to do a takeoff on, they can actually give you a ballpark cost based on what you have. And they'll give you a better number to work with in terms of budgeting for your project, getting financing for your office, because they your institute, if you're financing it, the financial institute is going to call, going to ask you, you know, what will it cost for construction? Well, you have to have something for the, you know, for the contractor to work from. Otherwise, that number could be, again, almost anywhere. So we typically encourage that you give them, you give the contractor something to work with so that they can give you a more realistic, workable number that you can, you know, you can afford. Okay, Jim?
Yeah, without a doubt, because it's crucial to be able to have a context around that number, because it can be, you know, it could be anything. It could be, you know, how big is the building? How, what's the finish level inside? What's the equipment? What, you know, just all those factors to be able to cause the cost to either go up or come down. And so, again, talk to the designer or the architect to get a hold of the contractor, get an idea of a potential preliminary design and put a cost to it, and at least then you'll have a better understanding. Again, you'll have facts to base that number around, but it's volatile. Well, Han, there was another discussion you wanted to have, and I can't remember what the item was. We have time to talk about it in the next 5 minutes?
Yeah, the construction cost for new buildings. It was, you know, it was posted for a discussion, and the dentist said, well, "Oh my gosh, it's, you know, it was a I got a sticker price shock because it's a new, you know, bought new land and they're going to build a new building, and their bid come back in with the number at $300 to $350 per square foot, and they say is that reasonable?" And unless you pose that question with all the information that associated with the building, the answer is, again, it's like, you know, pulling out of the air and give you an answer that you may like or you may not. It's very specific because the number was created or generated based on a set of construction document with engineering drawings and all that stuff specific for your site, for your building. If you take that same set of drawing, you are, you know, if the project already bid there, therefore it may have been bid between 3 to 4 qualified contractor. So the number, you know, whatever that number is, that's more than likely reasonable for that region. Now, can you get a lower number? Perhaps, but somebody who live, if let's say if you are in Texas and somebody's in Mississippi, would tell you, no, I did the same thing. I got a 5,000 square foot building on a 2 acres of land, and it cost me $125 to build my building. You might like that, but you're comparing apples to oranges. Okay, so it's almost a mute question. It's a fear to ask, but you have to ask that question to those in that region, within your, you know, within your area, and who've done basically very comparable type of construction, and all that, so that you have, and at the same time, a building that was built, same size, same material and all that, that was built 5 years ago under different circumstances, under different, you know, market compared to your project presently, under, you know, the present conditions, under the present price increase and uncertainties, your number is going to be different, very different. Now, years ago, you know, the common response to how much would typically, how much can I expect to pay for a tenant build out, $1 per square foot, and it's a very common practice among the design professional, is that it costs you, you know, plan to spend $100 per square foot. Okay, most of us was very comfortable with that, but then to say that now, 20, 30 years later, we're going to wear eggs because it's you can't hardly touch a tenant build out for $125 or even $150, and that is middle of the road, with very little bells and whistles.
In our region, if you take that to California, the Northwest or the Northeast, that number could quadruple. So, again, it's so geographically affected. It's so volatile in so many factors that really it is an impossibility for us to give a generic dollar per square foot. Now, I know why you're asking. You and I know why they're asking, because they're trying to determine whether they can do something and say, okay, I need to know what the dollar per square foot is so that, okay, can I afford a 5,000 square foot building? And you do the quick math. The quick math gives you whatever. And then I go to the bank and say, do I have the capability? Can I afford to do this project? I understand. That's logical. We understand what you're trying to do. The problem is it doesn't work.
But Jim, would it be more productive if you go to the bank first? Say, I like to build, I like to start a new office. Here's my financial statement and my earning and my liability and all that stuff. What can I afford? Wouldn't that be a better approach to know what you can afford? Even let's say you can only afford to build a 3,000 square foot building, but you ultimately need 5. Okay, you can either build, go and hock in a major way if you can, and build a 5,000 square foot when you only need to use 3,000 square foot of it. If you know what you can afford, and then you can design to meet that immediate need, and plan for future expansion, rather than simply go, I want to build 5,000 square foot, and if I can't afford it, I'm not going to do it.
Yeah, well, that's one way of thinking about it. But the problem is most lending institutions, with the exception of a few, don't have the knowledge base to know what construction costs are in their geographic region for a dental office. So they may say, okay, doc, based upon your financial situation, you can afford $2 million. Okay. But how does that equate to what does that give you? And the other part of the factor is the cost of that particular building and the appraised value of that building and your amount of down payment and all those kind of things. It's a very complicated process to go through. So the better approach is to, for example, spend a very little, but a little bit, but, get a preliminary design together, like one of our initial design concepts that we create for a pretty small investment, and then have that priced so at least you understand what your needs were. And you base that around your needs. And obviously there's needs, wants, and desires. We've talked about that before. So you need to have this. That's your bare minimum. You would like to have this. Okay, what's that going to cost? And my desire would be I'd love to have all of this. Well, nobody has all the money in the world to be able to do a particular project. So yeah, maybe it has to be phased, or maybe it's like, okay, I can deal with my, let me get my needs once and my desires, I'll put those off for down the road when I, you know, make my first $1 million through the practice and add on. So that's the better approach, because then you have a cost that's in the ballpark, substantiated by facts, meaning here's my concept, here's my preliminary cost from the a local builder, and then you take that to sit down with the lending institution and say, okay, how do we make the numbers work for this? That's the better approach. But not everybody likes to go that direction, but that's in our opinion, that's the best way to do it.
I'm with you. Okay, so that would be the approach to at least, the dollar per square foot cost is so misleading, especially if you throw it on the table to have it discussed across the country, because some people say, hey, I am out in the northwest, and you can't get a piece of land that's the size of a postage stamp without spending $1 million. Well, how does that apply to you, in the central part of the country where you can buy 10 acres of land for a handshake? A little exaggeration, right. But you know what I'm saying? It doesn't equate, and you have the information that is not relevant to your question, and it just confuses you more and actually answer your questions. So,
well, always, we've burnt through a whole hour plus, and hopefully, tonight's discussion has been helpful and creating some information that helps you, solve your particular problems. Just, I guess, in a recap, in conclusion, be very careful with what advice you're being given. See if it's backed up by facts. Ask for those particular facts to be able to justify the advice that's being put out there. And, does it hit the smell test? Does it smell right? Are the information that needs to help you make the decision there, or is it just somebody's opinion? So hopefully that's been helpful. We look forward to spending another hour with you next week. Hope you stay safe. As always, if you have any questions, you'd like to talk to Han and I, get a hold of us, call us, send us an email. We're here to help. We won't bite, and we do really do enjoy this. We're here to help. So hope that's at least been an informative time spent with us this evening. And Han, I'll let you have the last word.
You caught me, Jim. I like that when you say you don't bite. I do, on a day that doesn't end with a Y. All right. It's been a great, fun hour. Appreciate you spending the time with us. Hope everybody stays safe, happy, and keep your chin up, regardless what's going on around you. Until next time, have a good evening.
You've been listening to HJT Design Radio Straight Talk with Jim and Han. To contact us and find out more info about upcoming shows, please log on to our website at www.hjtdesign.com. Until next time.